Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, welcome to another fabulous episode we have here of Suspense Radio. I'm your host, John Robb. Today we have three outstanding guests. First going to be joining me is author Joshua Graham, followed by Leighton Green, or followed by Jeffrey Gerard, and then bringing it up, it will be Leighton Green. So it's just going to be a fabulous episode. We got a lot of things going on. 90 minutes of Suspense Radio starts right now. Welcome back here to Suspense Radio. We are going to jump right in here with our first guest. His book is out. It is called Terminus. We've known Joshua now for a couple of years, kind of followed his career as he's kind of made it up, and now he's really starting to get a lot of traction. It's really great to see how his transition has kind of gone from his first works now up to Terminus, and he just keeps climbing up the charts, so it's really great to be able to speak with him. So, Joshua, thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
Great, John. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be on this side of the mic for a change.
Right. You just interviewed me a couple weeks ago, and now I get to do the thing back. So, yeah, so it's kind of interesting to see the other side, because Joshua is also the host of Thriller Radio that is on Blog Talk Radio, another great show for people to check out. So, Terminus. Give us a little bit about it. That's not, you know, like that's not on the back cover.
Okay. Well, this is basically the story of a fallen angel who falls in love with the one person that he's meant to destroy, and so you've got a problem right there because, you know, the reason he falls from his position or chooses to fall is because he's really disillusioned. He doesn't see the point in taking all these innocent souls that, you know, basically ushering them to the afterlife. You've seen too many senseless deaths of children, of innocent people. Not that he caused them in his position as a reaper. He's just watching it happen. And his job, he's kind of been demoted. He used to be a guardian thousands of years ago. And because of something he did in his past, he was kind of, you know, put on a demoted status, or probationary status. So during the last couple of hundred years, he's just been doing a mundane task of ushering people from the here to the hereafter. And, you know, he's just gotten kind of really jaded and not seeing the point of why good people have to die prematurely. So that's one of the reasons he decides, you know what, I've had enough of this. And he gets recruited by another department that kind of promises him some, you know, a job that's going to be more meaningful, a job that's going to help him, you know, make a difference by taking down some very dangerous people. One of them is a drug cartel person. One of them is a suicidal woman, she seems to be harmless, but they're saying that she's probably the most dangerous of all. And one of them is a preacher. So he's got to bring about their downfall to protect people from going astray. But in the meantime, he falls in love with Hope Matheson. That's the suicidal woman. And now he decides he doesn't want to do this job anymore, but the mark is still on her. She, the assassination is still required, and so now they're after him. But as he decides to be with her, he has to renounce his angel immortality and powers. So as he does this, he's got to now deal with trying to protect her now rather than bring about her death. But he's losing his powers quickly. So this is just one of those things where he's transitioning from supernatural immortal to mortal, losing his powers but falling in love, and at the same time having to somehow outsmart the supernatural forces that are now out to get him and her. So this is just one of those wild rides which just came out of the imagination, and it's been a lot of fun to write it.
Now, some people who got you from here, reading you from Beyond Justice, might look at this and say, wow, this is kind of, you know, a little bit something different from Joshua than you've done in the past. But they might not realize is that, of course, you know, you wrote under Ian Alexander, and you kind of, and you wrote a fantasy novel back then called Once We Were Kings. So this is not really a new genre for you, but how are your fans kind of saying, wow, this is something that you kind of stepped into that's a little bit different?
You know, I haven't heard any complaints. In fact, I find that a lot of my fans have a very eclectic taste. So they like all kinds of genres. And really, this is kind of a paranormal, supernatural thriller. So it's kind of like a subgenre of thrillers. So that you still have all the thriller elements, but it's just put in a, you know, angels and demons type of setting. So in some ways, I think it's brought more people into my books, because people who people who weren't legal thriller fans or political thriller fans, people who are just paranormal, now they have something of mine that possibly they could get interested in. So it's been pretty good. I don't see any issues there. And in fact, you know, the truth is, in almost every one of my thrillers, there's a little bit of supernatural, a little bit of faith element, and to varying degrees. So it's not a total shock to my readers, I think.
And when you're looking back here, and the book just came out again, the book is called Terminus, and you can find Joshua at joshua-grand.com is his website. And, of course, you can listen to Thriller Radio and on Facebook and Twitter. Now, with the book Terminus, and when you decided that this is going to be your next book that you were going to bring out, was it the characters? Was it the story? What was kind of the conception mode from the very beginning when you said, okay, this is the one that I'm going to bring out now?
Well, I think it was the characters and the situation. I really loved putting my characters in somewhat impossible situations, conflicted situations where they really want something, but then they have to give up something to have it, or they really desire something, but that desire, you know, may not be right, or it may be on a gray area. So I thought of, like, the main focus was the fallen angel who falls in love with the person he's sent to destroy. What would happen if? And then I guess as I was going about writing up the outline and that type of thing, many different things came to mind, and one of the reasons why the leading female role, the person that our Angel Nikolai falls in love with, the reason her name is Hope is because she really embodies one of the main themes of there being a hope beyond all things, and you know, she's suicidal because of what's happened in her life. But I just wanted to bring across a certain theme that there's always hope, no matter how bad things are. There's always hope. Even beyond death, there's hope. So, the theme, the characters, the situations, that those are all what drove me to first write the book and then bring it out as the next book.
And do you think that a lot of thrillers or suspense books should maybe have like that underlining moral theme? Do you think that authors think about that consciously when they're writing the books, like, you know, like when they're writing the characters? Instead of just making sure their characters have morals so they are that more depth, do you think that it's a conscious decision to kind of maybe have a little moral embodiment along with, you know, the story?
Well, I can't really speak too much for other authors, but I have heard many of them say, no, I consciously try not to put in a moral but to the story. So that's what I've heard. I haven't heard anybody say they actually tried to do that. For me, I don't know if I actually tried to do that, but I do ask myself the question, like, what's the redeeming value that I'd like somebody to walk away from this book and consider? So if, it's sort of like my driving force to writing the book. I don't want to just write a book that is exciting, though I do want it to be exciting and entertaining. And though I want it to be entertaining, I do want it to be something that when somebody walks away from it, they will have gained something, a perspective. And whether they agree with it or not, at least it gives them something to think about and consider. So, you know, those type of things, themes are something I think are very important. I mean, take film writers. I think they are always thinking in terms of visual themes, things that a controlling idea. So everything in your setting, in the frame of the film has to kind of lead, kind of point towards that controlling idea. So, yeah, I do ask myself certain questions like that. But once I've established what those themes are, it kind of goes into the subconscious, and I just kind of write the story with a kind of subconscious awareness of what I'm trying to bring across.
And when you started out, I mean, you were definitely one of the hardest working authors that I saw marketing wise. You know, getting yourself out, especially with Beyond Justice and doing all the work and, you know, getting your name out there and everything else. Have you kind of still embraced that role, or if you tend to take a little step back, you know, because it was just so much? You know, how you kind of do things nowadays that you did maybe 3 years ago?
Well, you know, early on when I first started, it was kind of easier to do so much of that because I had already finished the book. The book was already out there. And I wasn't at the time necessarily writing and publishing the next book. So I had all this time to go hog wild and try everything there was in marketing and push the limits to some point, if there were limits, and see what it was like. But after that first year, you start to get a feel for what works and what doesn't work and when you need to change your tactics and change your strategies. Then came the point where it's like, okay, I have to write the next book now. So I think that it kind of comes and goes in waves. If I'm in the middle of writing a book like I am right now, I'll probably be a little bit less involved in book promoting, and but I do like to kind of stay in touch with my platform, with my fan base, by engaging them in social media and just kind of letting them know I'm still there, I'm still thinking about you guys. Here's a funny cat picture or something like that, or throw out a question, you know, what do you think about this or that? But when the book is actually finished, like when Terminus first came out, yeah, I'll spend a quite a bit of time, you know, letting all the different outlets and bloggers and people know about that and doing interviews on blogs and even shows like this. So, again, it comes in waves as depending on what the writing schedule is like.
Yeah, because you got picked up by Simon & Schuster, am I correct?
Yes, for Darkroom.
Yeah, for Darkroom, because Beyond Justice, you know, did so well, then they picked you up for Darkroom. Now, how was kind of that marriage? Because you were kind of self-publishing it, and all of a sudden then you kind of went into, you know, the Big Six thing. I mean, was it like a big change for you, and is it still a change, still something you're learning?
You know, again, marketing, for whether you're doing independently or with a traditional publisher, I think it's a moving target. So you have to really be on the cutting edge and following how things go. Not necessarily because as a writer you're not chasing the market in terms of what to write, but in terms of how you promote, what seems to work and what doesn't work, it changes like every few months. So my experience with them, they were very supportive in terms of publicity. They actually... for a debut traditional author, I was very blessed that they actually had a publicity budget. So they were able to get me onto different radio shows, onto a TV spot, and that type of thing. So you can see that when a major publisher has certain clout in the media, it's definitely helpful. So that was helpful. But still, the difference was kind of not having complete control over it. And I'm okay with that, but I guess once in a while when I do my own work, I'm a one-man show in terms of the project leader, and I have different people who help me out with different things, but I'm kind of the one organizing the schedule and watching things get, making sure things get done. When I partnered with Simon & Schuster, I wasn't necessarily the boss anymore. I was more of a collaborator, and I was kind of at the mercy of their schedule. And rather than working as a one-man show, now you've got like a company of hundreds of people. employees and all that, and with their own other projects they have to deal with. So there's, you know, a little bit less leanness in terms of how a business is run that way, which you would expect from big publishers. So, you know, for me, there was a bit of a give and take and adjustment of expectations I had to go through.
Now, let's kind of jump into your radio show. You know, you do Thriller Radio, and I think it's thrillerradio.org is your website.
Correct.
Where people can go and,
yeah,
and hear all the past. So what was kind of, you know, when you decided, hey, this is something I want to do on the radio, aside from write books, because a lot of authors aren't going to do that. I mean, either you're a writer or kind of you're not, and you're on the other side like I am. Why did you decide, hey, you know what, I kind of want to get on the radio and interview other authors and kind of play almost both sides of the fence?
Well, you know, actually, John, you were pretty much the inspiration for that, because for the past 3 years before Thriller Radio started, Susan Wingate, my dear friend and a really great author, and I, we after my first interview on Suspense Radio 3 years ago, we were so inspired by it, we decided we wanted to put together a show, Dialogue Between the Lines. And we did that for 3 years together and happily, and it was sad when, you know, this opportunity came up for that I had to leave that show to do this one. And we left on really great terms and still great friends. The whole concept of interviewing other authors was just a really fun thing, a very edifying thing for me, because I love talking with other authors and picking their brains and hearing what they have to say. Thriller Radio came about after being part of the International Thriller Writers Organization for about 2 years. And every time I went to Thriller Fest, I would meet these authors, and there's so little time to talk in depth, but I would get to ask them a few questions, and I kept thinking, you know, there's so many thriller writers here that seem to enjoy discussing what they do, but there's never enough time. So after speaking to a few different people, key people at Thriller Fest, we all thought it was a great idea. We can do something that's more thriller-focused. And give an opportunity for ITW members as well as other thriller writers to get on a radio show. And so because I already had the experience, that's why I branched off from Dialogue, because I was more focused on the thriller genre alone, whereas Dialogue is Between the Lines is a more eclectic and more all-encompassing writing show. That's how it came about, and it's been really fun. We've had Hugh Howey. Next week we're going to have Preston and Child. And a whole bunch of other great authors. We had Diane Capri, we had C.J. Lyons just last week, and it's really been fun for me to talk with them, because and I was talking to you about this earlier, John. As I'm hosting the show, I'm actually taking notes and listening, you know, writing down some of the cool things they say and learning from them.
Yeah, and that's always funny that I kind of do. I don't. It's just from listening to them and being able to, you know, just to get inside some of their brains, because it's always interesting to me of, like, how someone who writes a story, you know, so well, how do they click? How do they think? You know, do they just think a little bit different than normal people, and that's kind of what they do? You know, Stephen King, of course, has always been one to my, and I was able to interview him. And when you talk with somebody like that, you realize that they are always thinking outside the box. And that's the one thing that I think that authors young coming up need to realize is to think outside the box instead of just trying to rehash kind of the same old thriller story. Is to think something different. And that's what I love. And that's what I love about this, you know, talking to those authors.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think thinking outside the box is, you don't want to do it just for the sake of doing it. You still want to write a great story that fits in the parameters. But then again, there's been so many books written in this genre, and so many of them even inadvertently just sound like the other, you know, other 100 books written in the same, you know, decade. How does one go about doing something really unique? And again, like I said, I don't think we want to be unique just for the sake of being unique, but at the same time, we do want to bring something. Every individual is unique, so I think the best way approach is to find, like, okay, this may be the same theme or same type of story, but this is how I tell it, this is how I see it, because if you bring in your own unique personality to it, then the book itself will be at least to some degree different from everybody else's.
Yeah, I don't know how many times, you know, we get books and or emails and press releases, and it's the same thing. It's, you know, this killer is the most diabolical killer ever, and this hero is the greatest hero ever. And it's like, people, you really got to come up with different taglines for your books, because I've seen and heard all that before. It's like, please, that's why it's so great when you see someone like yourself that you step around different, you know, you're still in suspense, you're still in thriller, but you like to step off of that gray area, you know, out of that gray area, or I'm sorry, out of that black and white area into that gray area where it's something that's different. So when you get a book like yours, like Terminus, it's not just the normal kind of straightforward kind of thriller. There's always something else that's always in that gray area that separates yourself from just that basic thriller writer who just kind of just keeps doing the same thing over and over and not really evolving their writing.
Well, I'm really glad that that's something that you appreciate. And I've found that, you know, a lot of other readers have had a similar experience with it, because I'm trying not to be just like everybody else. But at the same time, you know, what I'm bringing into it is not like I'm just thinking, okay, how weird can I be or how different can I be? I just, you know, maybe I put a little bit more of my own, you know, worldview into things like that. And it just happens to be that maybe there haven't been that many other authors who insert that into a thriller. So that could be a double-edged sword, because there are some people, for example, bringing in the faith element. My books are not what I would call Christian fiction, because they don't fit the mold of that. And yet I do bring in some of my Christian faith values into it, but not in a way that beats you over the head and says like, you know, you better believe in this or you're going to hell. Nothing like that. It's just I bring it up in some of my characters, and some of my characters have that faith. And then they have some philosophical discussions now and then, or sometimes the themes revolve around it. But at the end of the day, the reader comes away from the book and says, that was interesting. And they can either decide, I want to know more about it, or, that's not for me. And the book leaves it completely open-ended for them to decide for themselves what they think. But at least they get a chance to, you know, consider something that I think is important.
You know, what's kind of funny is we were just sitting here talking about thinking outside the box. I swear I didn't see this before, but I was just on your website. And again, everybody, it's joshua-graham.com. If you click on the blog, the first one you see is called Determination and Thinking Outside the Box. Now, I don't know if it was just some kind of subconscious thing that was in there, but I'm like, and I swear I did not see that before, so I thought that was kind of funny. I had to bring it up. But, you know, I see that you had a giveaway here for the audiobook edition. So how, you know, how is that when you hear your story in that kind of format? I mean, it's got to be, I don't know. I mean, how is it for you?
Well, you know, you're probably talking about the audiobook version of Terminus, and that was released a few months ago, on Audible. So it's on Audible, on Amazon. I think you can get it through iTunes. But we came across this professional narrator by the name of Daniel Dorst, and he is amazing, because I had to really listen to dozens of auditions for this book, and there were some people who are pretty good and some people who are not so good. But when I heard Daniel Dorst's rendition of Terminus, I said, it was just head and shoulders above the rest. Mm-hmm. He was just the perfect person for this audiobook. So when I listened to it, it's almost like, you know, I haven't had my books made into movies yet, but this was, I imagine, very similar to what it would feel like, because he brought the book to life. He wasn't just reading the book, but he was like an actor. He would use different voices for the different characters and different inflections. And my book has a lot of different people with, like, you know, Mexican, Russian, and, you know, people from New York accents like that. And he does it so convincingly, and he doesn't, and like I said, he dramatizes it to the point where you really feel like you're listening to the audio of a movie. So that was really exciting for me. As I said, it brought the whole book to life. And I certainly hope that, you know, if you like audiobooks, you'd check out the Terminus audiobook, because it makes it really fun to listen to and hear again. His name is Daniel Dorst. He's a great narrator.
And now that's the only book that's on Audible from you, right, Terminus?
The only novel. We're working on the audio version for Once We Were Kings and Beyond Justice. I'm still listening to auditions, but we also have two short stories out there, The Accidental Healer, narrated by David Pevsner, another great actor. He's actually been on the screen, on television and movie screen. And another one called The Accidental Exorcist, read by, Melissa. Oh, I'm so sorry, Melissa. I forgot her last name. But she's also like been on like CSI and Criminal Minds. She's been a really well-versed actress, and she read that too.
Well, we got about a minute here left. So,
okay,
for fans that are just coming into you, and they're kind of saying, okay, you know, picking up Terminus, and you have Beyond Justice, you have Darkroom, and everything like that. What's one of the one thing that you tell them, hey, you know, pick this up, look at this, this is kind of who I am as an author, and, you know, how do you answer that question when they're just finding out about you and want to know who you are?
Well, I would just say, you know, have an open mind, as you probably should with every author, because every author is a little bit different, and, you know, I think if you're looking for books that will entertain you but also give you something to think about, or if you're not a religious person but you don't mind, you know, seeing what somebody thinks about faith and all that without having to beat you over the head with it, I think the books that I write will probably be a good fit for you. And, you know, even if you totally are non-religious, I think I've seen a lot of non-religious people really enjoy the books too. So the main thing is, you know, story is what's important. It doesn't really matter in what form it comes. You know, if you enjoy stories of people that go through really difficult struggles and come out victorious or with hope, if you're looking for books that will inspire you and give you, besides the entertainment and thrills, you know, some kind of hope for a better day, or, you know, for something beyond your circumstances, I think you probably will enjoy any one of the books I've written.
Well, I'll tell you what, Joshua, we want to thank you always so much for coming on. It's always great to talk with you. It's great to see everything that you've been doing and just how you've, like I said, how you've been starting to climb up and get new fans, and you're kind of getting yourself out and different kind of suspense stuff. It's always fabulous. So I want to thank you again so much for coming on.
Well, thank you so much, John. It's a privilege and an honor.
All right. How are we going, Joshua? We'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye.
All right, bye. So again, everybody, that is author Joshua Graham. It's joshua-graham.com. The book is called Terminus. It's available now to go get, and we say Christmas is coming up, and there's a lot of great books that are out there to go get. Terminus is one. Also, Jevon Banks is searching for a killer and answers two terrifying questions he never even thought to ask. So you need to check out Singularity, Stephen James, and go to stephenjames.net for more information. Call Alpaw comes out with his latest book, The Spy's Little Zombie, and you need to go to coffeetownpress.com or coalpaugh.com for all the exciting details. Also, Thriller Fest 9 is now open for registration. The conference is July 8th through the 12th at the Grand Hyatt in New York City, so go to thrillerfest.com for more information there. We are going to be back here in just a second with our next guest. Cain's Blood is the book. The author is Jeffrey Gerard. Very excited to talk with him. So give us about 2 minutes and right back at you. So welcome back, everybody, out of the break. Again, we want to thank Joshua Graham for coming on and speaking about his book, Terminus. But now we are going to transition over to our next guest. His book is called Cain's Blood, a fabulous read, gotten wonderful reviews. One of them said, Crichton meets King. And so when you have a view like that from somebody, you definitely know you have to go pick up the book. The author is Jeffrey Gerard. So, Jeffrey, thanks so much for coming on. How you doing?
Hey, thanks for having me on. Thanks for starting with Crichton meets King. That ain't bad.
Well, when you see that, what are you going to do? I mean, you see Crichton meets King, and you see all the great reviews that you've been able to get. You know, R.L. Stine, come in, Booklist, Kirkus. You've gotten some fabulous reviews from the book. So why don't you let everybody know a little bit about Cain's Blood that's maybe not on the back cover to kind of get a little bit more information into what you created here.
It's not on the back cover. Let's see, Crichton meets King. Man, not on the back cover is the sort of high-concept pitch, which is, you know, good writers borrow and great writers steal. I teach that to my students. I'm a high school teacher. It's Jurassic Park with serial killers. And that's what it doesn't say on the back cover. The idea of clone, it's clones. It's but instead of cloning dinosaurs, the evil government scientist types, the way they always do, have gotten interested in the genetics of violence. So they've gone to the best of the best, and they've cloned some of the biggies like Bundy and Dahmer and Gacy and those types. And they're all in their teens now, and bad ones get out and do bad things, and there are a couple good ones left, and they sort of help. But, I guess what's not on the cover is that Gerard ripped off Jurassic Park and just made it scarier. Or at least that was the intention. Dinosaurs aren't scary to me, so they just weren't cool enough, and serial killers are, and I wanted to do something with that.
And so was serial killers something that you have maybe studied or looked at for quite some time? Have you always been interested kind of in that area?
Yeah, the way a lot of people are. Again, I keep doing these interviews, and people are like, who's your favorite serial killer? And then they'll giggle because they realize, what a silly question that is, but we all sort of have one. Yeah, I certainly said I've been interested for a while. The original, there's a magazine called Apex Digest Magazine. They changed their name, but it's Apex. They do science fiction and horror. That's their specialty. And for years I was trying to get them to publish one of my stories, but they were either too much horror or too much science fiction. It was one or the other, not both. And the cloning meets serial killers was, to me, the best way to combine the two. So that's how I landed there. I figured I could one-up. Boys from Brazil is a great idea, but Hitler probably really wasn't all that scary. a clone of Hitler, it's not too physically intimidating or all that brilliant, just sort of right place, wrong time, or wrong place, right time, whatever. So I wanted to one-up that as well.
And so your main character, Sean Castillo, kind of a formal black ops soldier, like you say, he says a man with demons of his own. Give us a little bit about, who that man is. Was he one, or tell us why he is the right person to be the forefront here in Cain's Blood.
I wanted, being the English major, English teacher type that I am, I try to hide it, but I'm driven by theme. I'm a theme writer and a theme thinker, and those are the books that attract me and, the writing projects that attract me. So, the easy theme for this book is nature-nurture. It's a study of nature and nurture. What is it? Where does violence come from? Mm-hmm. And the boy in the story is the genetic clone of Jeffrey Dahmer. So we know where his violence comes from. It's nature. He is 100% genetic clone of Jeffrey Dahmer, and so that's what he has to deal with. Castillo, I wanted the opposite. I wanted the polar opposite. I wanted a guy who, because of the army training, has been trained to kill. It's not in his nature necessarily, other than the biological instincts that we all have to carry that out if we have to. But the truth is, our biological instincts, we're not really that prone to killing. Our military,
right.
the studies that they've done coming out of World War II, they were finding the numbers of soldiers who weren't actually shooting their guns. And would either literally pass their gun off to another soldier, like, look, I can't shoot this dude. Like, here's my gun, you shoot it. And these rifles were being returned unfired post-World War II. And it really got them thinking, who are we sending off to war to fight these battles for us? So they started changing the training. They started changing the way they teach American soldiers to kill. And lo and behold, our fire rates went up. So that by the time, Iraq War, they're at like 100%. you know, in Iraq, or not Iraq, Vietnam, whatever, 90%.
Yeah, Vietnam.
World War II,
yeah.
like 60, 65%, like really startling numbers. Human beings don't like killing other human beings. So it is training. It is nurture that teaches good old American boys to go over there and get the job done. And, you know, thank God someone's got to do that job. But, you know, part of what the post-traumatic stress syndrome, and this is Castillo's thing, it's tough to come back from that. I mean, what's the difference between that and being one of these boy soldiers over in Africa? Yeah, I get it. You volunteered. You chose to do it. But at the end of the day, you've been trained. When something looks humanoid and it's a bad guy, you know, pop it in the head. That's tough to turn off. I mean, that's what we're finding. And so I wanted to explore that. You know, we know that the nature screwed up the Jeff Jacobson Dahmer clone, and I wanted to show how nurture could also affect a human being as he wrestles with that. So that's where I came up with this video.
I guess if you watch, like, Full Metal Jacket, and you see how they trained for the Vietnam, where you see normal guys coming in and, like, you know, Vincent D'Onofrio's character, kind of a normal, maybe fun-loving guy turn into what he turned into, I guess
right.
You can maybe understand exactly what you're talking about the nurturing part of, you turn them into a psychopath almost.
Well, the first thing they did was they changed the targets. Back in World War II, you would shoot at round little circles. Like, you know, if you go to a gun range, well, actually they've changed that now too. I don't know, whatever, you were in Boy Scouts, you'd shoot at a little round target. Well, that's what they were
right.
shooting at in World War II. And that's sort of like, oh, you know what, maybe they should shoot at a shape that's humanoid. And now they shoot at things, you know, bounce around walls and are three-dimensional, and literally when you shoot them, blood will splatter behind the thing that you just shot to get you used to that and get you, like, you know, recognizing certain shapes and react, respond, done, nurture.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
yeah,
I mean,
we're a fair more advanced than Full Metal Jacket. Our guys shoot at about 100% now.
Yeah, and that's a phenomenal kind of, you know, psychological approach, because nature and nurture, of course, has always been debated psychology-wise. And, you know, you said, you know, you're an English person, so you had to kind of go back and, you know, did you kind of study any of that psychology, whether you took a class or whether you talked to any professors and things like that to maybe better understand what you were getting yourself into when you were going to write about that kind of a topic?
Yeah, I went to books, though. It's funny. This is like my first novel, but it's like the fifth or sixth book. And previous books, I would go and talk to experts. You know, I'd drive for 7 hours to meet some guy. And I very quickly learned that, you know, you ask two people a question, they give you three answers. So as a writer, you know, the idea of going off to meet all these experts, it was not very conducive to, you know, it wasn't helpful for my time, and it wasn't all that great. It's nice to get out and meet people and stuff like that. But so I can get that just as easily from a book. I went to books. I went to modern science as far as the science of violence and aggression and where that comes from, as it is in 2013. You know, and that's probably going to change in 10, 15 years anyway. You know, 50 years ago, violence was based on how big your forehead was and whether or not your chin stuck out and crap like that. So, you know, how right are we now? I don't know. There are certainly books and articles that claim there are certain genes to watch for. And this one I focus on in my book, this XP11 gene, that it, if there is an abnormality on it, that it does perhaps shows a predisposition to above and beyond violence. And that they've been focused on that one for about a decade now. So just the way we figure out why eyes are blue and legs are long and that kind of thing.
Now,
and as far as the psychology, that's just... No, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, the psychological aspect, I've certainly spent a lot of time with serial killers about a year or 2 years ago when I was researching this book. I usually do research for about a year before I even write a word. And so it was a lot of time spent with the kind of profiles written by psychologists and these people who go in and talk to them and either a video interview or a book, you know, following their case history and going back to their childhoods and interviews with and looking at the psychological aspects of what they're going through. So I try to do a combination of both.
So now just a little off topic, because this, you're the first English, like, teacher that I've actually talked to that's actually written a book, as a lot of English teachers always say they're going to do it, but then they never do. So when you kind of wrote the book and you sent it to your editor and she sent it back and you had a lot of red marks, did you kind of feel a little sympathetic to all those students that you did that to?
No, if anything, yeah,
like,
I'm sorry.
Oh,
the road
I feel so sorry for you guys now. Now I know how you feel when you get your papers back.
Probably more felt sorry for my students. I'm like, God, I'm not a good enough teacher. I should mark up their papers more. I'm like, geez, I should rip on their papers more. No, I didn't take it that bad. See,
yeah. Go ahead.
Fortunately for me, I was in corporate advertising for 10 years before I started teaching and writing. So that'll kill your soul fast enough that, believe me, I had good people looking at that. I used to have, you know, vice presidents that couldn't put four words together before looking at my writing and changing it. So once you learn to deal with that, once I went to the editors at Simon Schuster, when they were sending stuff back to me, I'm like, you know, thank God, here's someone who knows what they're doing. So most of them were just delightful.
And I want to remind everybody here that we're speaking with author Jeffrey Gerard. That's Jeffrey with a G, so G-E-O, Gerard.com, and the book is Cain's Blood. And the one thing that a lot of people might wonder is, like, they see another book called Project Cain. Now, it's they're two different books, but they're still kind of about the same fictional event. So what's the separation of Cain's Blood and Project Cain?
Cain's Blood tells the full story. It's everything we've been talking about. Military clone serial killers, bad ones get out. This military guy is brought in to sort of clean up the mess, and he ends up teaming up with a 16-year-old clone of Jeffrey Dahmer. And the two of them run around, and a bunch of stuff happens, and you get to see victims being tormented and all that kind of good stuff. Project Cain is specifically written for teen readers, young adult, and it is first-person point of view just from Jeff Jacobson's point of view. That's the guy who's the clone of Dahmer. So it is totally his viewpoint as he goes through these things and goes on his own adventures. And the geek version I tell is, I don't know why this one comes to mind, but people seem to understand it. Cain's Blood is Star Wars, and Project Cain is Chewbacca's story. You know, I don't know why that's what comes to mind, but, you know, what the hell, I don't know what the hell Chewbacca does during that, other than he's not very good at chess, but, you know, what is it that he does with his time? Surely he's off doing something. You know, we know where he is at certain key moments, but there are huge blocks of time. I'm not sure what he's up to. And what this book does is it sort of follows that. So we get a more personal version of a kid coming to terms with. Most teen novels are like, ooh, I don't know who I am. I need to discover who I am. And I've tried to twist that because the kid's father comes in, drops the folder on his bed and says, I'm telling you exactly who you are. You're Jeffrey Dahmer, and good luck with that. And then dad takes off because dad's a bit of a twisted dude. And so this kid has the exact opposite problem of most teenagers. He knows exactly who he is and sort of has to come to terms with that. So that is for the teen market.
And I was thinking, I think you're the first author that's ever done this. I cannot think of another one that kind of wrote a teen novel with their adult novel on the same thing but from a different point of view. So I don't think I've ever heard that before.
I hear that a lot. I'm sure, somewhere, sometime it must have happened, but I certainly hear that a lot. To come out on the same day was kind of cool. And, you know, kudos to Simon & Schuster for taking that shot and to my agents, too, for suggesting it. I mean, just so you know, that was a suggestion by my agents. I had originally pitched them a teen novel, and they're like, they read it, and they say, hey, you're a good writer, but can you do an adult version of this? And I wrote that. And they're like, okay, we can sell this. And the exact same phone call, they're like, hey, how about the teen version? And I'm like, well, that's kind of where we started. But, you know, they're the ones that thought it was a good enough story that they could approach some of the bigger publishers and maybe find someone who was willing to do both. And so Simon & Schuster was creative and cool. They went for it. Yeah, I don't know. A lot of people say it's the first time they've heard of it. And sure, I bet somewhere there's someone who has or soon will. You know, I have a feeling a bigger author at this stage could have some fun with that, but it was a cool exercise, and it's neat to find people who are finding both books.
Yeah, I mean, maybe someone has done it, and maybe they'll do it again, but I don't think anyone's ever done it as their debut coming into the genre. That's going to be something that you probably broke the ground with that one.
Well, again, all thanks
yeah.
to Simon Schuster and my
thing.
Agents. Absolutely. Yeah, thanks for pointing it out.
And now, the other thing is that when people come up and they're new to you, whether you're at a bookstore or a book signing or a blog tour or you're on, you know, different things that you can interact with fans, and they kind of say, So should I read, you know, Project Cain? Should I read Cain's book? Does it make a difference, or do you have, like, an order to say, you know what, if you start with this, this might make more sense, or back and forth? How do you kind of answer that question?
Cain's Blood is written for adults. It's R-rated, written for adults. If you like Stephen King and Michael Crichton, read Cain's Blood, okay? Project Cain was specifically written for teenage readers. And then I got the idea, you know, teaching high school English, my guys, I'm in an all-boys school, they started talking about serial killers one day, and I'm the kind of teacher who lets that happen. And they started popping off with trivia, and I was nailing every question, and they're interested. And they're interested the way we were at 14, 15, 16. Like, they kind of know the names, but not really. You know, 90% of the class had no idea who Jeffrey Dahmer was. And I'm looking at him like, you gotta know who that is. Come on. That's the classics, boys. And so the original idea for Project Cain was, you know, Intro to Serial Killers 101 for teen readers, young adult readers, people who are, hey, I'm a little interested in something a little darker than Hunger Games or Harry Potter, but I don't really know who these guys are. I mean, I have their pictures of these guys in here and facts and statistics. It's more of I sneak in a lot of nonfiction because that's what specifically boy readers like and younger readers. So Project Cain's for the teen crowd. Yeah, there was some guy railing on me online, and God bless him for picking up the book. But he was all mad because I didn't learn a thing reading this book. And he was, you know, like a 35-year-old dude who loves serial killers. And I wanted to, you know, reach out to the guy and say, I'm so sorry. Like, it wasn't meant for you. Read Cain's Blood. You might learn something. Project Cain is for a kid who doesn't know who Jeffrey Dahmer is. So there are, right. Yeah, there are a lot of kids I met at a book signing just last weekend where I'd say something about Jeffrey Dahmer, and the parents' eyes would, like, turn into saucers, and a 15-year-old kid would just stare at me like, who the hell is that? And I'd be like, exactly. And that's what this Jeff Jacobson kid thinks. So he's on the same path you are. He doesn't know who these guys are either. So go on that journey together. So Cain's Blood, very R-rated for adults. Project Cain is for the teenagers. And, you know, there are a lot of – most YA fiction is being read by adults technically. So if there are people who like, you know, a first-person point of view, teenage kid who's wrestling a little bit with who he is, if you're into that kind of book. It's funny, as I was writing, I kept thinking about Perks of Being a Wallflower, which – seems a far cry from clone serial killers, but it's a very personal story about a teen kid sort of coming to terms with who he is.
You know, and the one thing is that we have another show on here called Crime and Science Radio that's hosted by D.P. Lyle and Jan Burke. And Jan actually interviewed a woman who, she was one of the lead people who would speak with Ted Bundy all the time about his story. She met him in jail. She did the whole thing. She knew him very well. And just to be able to hear those kinds of things about, like, who he was as a person, things of this, I mean, it's always kind of been interesting to me. And I always, and then I pose the question, and I'm going to ask you, because now you've researched a lot, do you think that it would be right for us to, you know, execute these people, or should we leave them alive on the sheer fact of maybe picking their brain and learning more and more about them? To maybe help future generations and police officers and things like that and seeing different things in different people.
There was a lot attached to that question. Well, I'm not a big execution guy, so that...
Yeah, I always just felt you could learn more from them instead of just killing them and getting... And, you know, now, of course, Dahmer was not executed. He was killed in prison.
Killed in prison,
but,
right.
You know, Bundy was, and, you know, those types. I always thought it would be more interesting to just keep them alive to understand them better of what is going on in that mind, because it's so different than just the normal gang guy going around and shooting somebody. I mean, these are literally psychopathic people. And I just thought that that would be more interesting for psychologists, and, you know, but that was just me. Now, of course, they feel like, no, there's nothing more you can get out of them. You might as well just get rid of them. But I don't know.
Or lock them up. I think I've spent too much time in a Catholic high school. I'm like, stop killing people. Killing's wrong. It says the horror guy who kills 400 people in his novel.
But then you write about it. That's
the funny thing. Yes, exactly. Hey, look, once someone's caught, put them away. Jeffrey Dahmer, yeah. It's funny. I met the warden about a month ago, the warden of the prison, when Dahmer was in Ohio for a while. And he described the cliche you'd expect, quiet, polite,
yeah.
Sensitive, always did what he was told, wanted to know, you know, needed books from the library. Sure, there's plenty to be learned. Unfortunately, it's the same story over and over again. You know, obviously, people are different, but there are so many similarities between these guys. I went with Dahmer because he's the one that sort of stood out as not being abused, not being neglected, not his childhood wasn't as horrendous as a lot of these guys were. But unfortunately, it is the same story a little bit, time and time again. Obviously, there are different circumstances, but boiled down, most of these guys had really crappy childhoods mixed in with
the
psychological differences.
And did you ask the warden, you know, did the cops kind of wink, wink, turn the other way?
Turn the other way for what?
In the bathroom. When he was beaten in the bathroom. I mean, come on.
That I did not follow up on. No, I was. It's funny. I was in my Dahmer phase. I'm so interested in. Because I got this Jeff Jacobson kid. I'm so interested in Dahmer as a real human being now that I didn't pursue that. I was just interested in the way he talked and moved and those kinds of things. Yeah, there are a lot of reports that suggested that it was a bit of a suicide even. That has been discussed in several sources, that Dahmer himself may have sort of arranged that and put that together. Yeah.
Well, I don't know, and a lot of people might not realize, of course, he was in Milwaukee, and that's where he was found and did a lot of his stuff, but his actual first killings were done in Akron, and Ohio wanted to bring him back because they did have the death penalty, and Wisconsin did not, and he was never able to stand trial for those crimes. So that's always a little bit more interesting, too. Maybe he felt the heat. I have no idea. I don't know what goes through those guys' heads at any given time. But that was interesting that he actually started in Ohio, and where you're from, and where I'm from.
Yes. Well, where we've both lived. I think you and I have determined we're from other places, but yeah, it's been 20 years. Eventually, I'm going to have to say I'm from Ohio. I live here.
Yeah, and I'm fine. I'm sorry for that, Jeffrey.
There's nothing to apologize for. It's a delightful state.
I got out.
And it has been interesting these last 6 months. I'm not joking. I have met, and I didn't, because I'm out promoting this book, I have met the warden of the prison. I have met a girl whose best friend went to prom with him. I have met a guy who went to high school with him, not his high school with. Like, he was doing imitations of Dahmer, walking down the hall and imitating the way he talked and stuff like that. Oh, who are the other? They're like six or seven. In that regard, being in Ohio is wonderful. Like, I keep bumping into these people that are like, oh, my God, this book's about Dahmer, and then they'll tell you some story about how they babysat him once. There's Ohio for you.
Yeah, I know, really. There's Ohio. I mean, we got the crazies out here in, California, too, with Manson and the Night Stalker and the Zodiac Killer and Black Dahlia and everything else. But, yeah, Ohio, and some people didn't realize, too, that, Bundy actually was going to pass through Ohio, and he never ended up doing that. I found that out.
Yeah, Manson spent a lot of time here, too. He grew up
down
here in Kentucky, Southern Ohio.
Ohio is with people. Ohio is doing this to people. I keep telling people, get out while you still can. It's that stupid Ohio State Buckeyes. You got to leave them. they're the evil ones. So, we got about a minute or so left here, and I want to, give you kind of like the last word about Cain's Blood and everything else that you have going on where people maybe can find you or anything else. So, take the last minute to just kind of, tell people what you're doing, where you're doing, where you're going in the future, Cain's Blood, anything that you want to talk about.
Okay. JeffreyGerard.com, G-E-O-F-F-R-E-Y, Gerard, G-I-R-A-R-D.com. I just encourage you to go to Amazon or wherever your site is, get online, check out Cain's Blood or Project Cain, and, check out those first couple chapters, see if it's something you'd be interested in. I grew up reading guys like Peter Straub and Stephen King and Lovecraft and all those guys, so I have a feeling that if you're listening to the show, we grew up reading the same guys and enjoy the same authors. So, give me a shot, give it a look, and if you like the first couple chapters, then pick the thing up. That's what I'd say.
And do you go to any conferences like Thriller Fest or BoucherCon? You're going to be out there in the field?
I've been doing a bunch. It's been like 4 or 5 months of like every other weekend I'm at something. I'm about to take it easy for the winter here, but it'll pick up again, and there'll be stuff on the website. You can follow me on Twitter, Jeffrey_Gerard, and I'm sure I'll announce stuff there as well. But I'll come across people as we go along. And then next things I'm writing on now, of course, I'm working on more dark thrillers and horror stuff, so I expect that you'll see me again sometime soon.
Well, that's great, Jeffrey. Hey, we want to thank you so much for coming on. And you know what? It's 2 o'clock now in Ohio. It's time for Fratelli's, so I don't want to go ahead. I don't want to hold you up from that because I know how wonderful that pizza is. So, again, is. Jeffrey, thanks
an
for coming on.
An official endorsement of Fratelli's Pizza, absolutely.
Yeah, gotta. If you're ever in Westchester, Ohio, go to Fratelli's Pizza. You will not be sorry. I'll just say that.
Absolutely.
That's
not
about the only good thing to, you know, Fratelli's and I-70 are the only two things to come out of good things to come out of Ohio. That's all I'm gonna say.
Oh, will you just stop? go play golf. Yeah,
I'm gonna go play golf right when I'm done. All right, Jeffrey.
Go Buckeyes. All right.
Going. I appreciate it.
Thanks very much, man. I appreciate the time.
So, again, everybody, that is also Jeffrey Gerard, jeffreygerard.com, GEOFFREY, and then GIRARD.com. The book is Cain's Blood for all you adult readers. And you know what? If you're the adult reader, for your teenage son, pick up Project Cain, and you can both read the story, and then you can both talk about it and see what's going on. What a great way to take away from game night but to reading night. Here with Cain's Blood and then the teen version, Project Cain. So you can check out those books. Very fascinating story and something that I've not really seen ever happen before. So Jeffrey is kind of breaking some ground in something brand new, and it's always great to see that in the thriller suspense genre. Again, you got Christmas coming up. It's around the corner, I know. We only got about a month and a half left, and everybody's talking Black Friday and all these other things that are happening. And what else we have is John Land, because John Land is strong. And his latest book, Strong Rain Falling, is a perfect Christmas stocking stuffer. You go to johnlandbooks.com for more information. And M.R. Sellers is the author of the wonderful Rowan and Gant Investigation Series. So you can check out everything paranormal by going to mrsellers.com and everything that they have going on over there. So we're going to be back here with our next guest. His name is Leighton Green, and we've not spoken with Leighton before, so it's great to always have new people on. He is the author of the Dominic Gray series, just released. It's called The Diabolicist, so this should be very interesting to speak with Leighton Green, and we will have him on right after the break. So enjoy this. welcome back, everybody, here after the break. Again, I want to thank of our first two authors that were on, Joshua Graham, and then we just had Jeffrey Gerard on talking about their works. We are now going into our last guest. The book that he just put out, and I said it wrong, it's called The Diabolist. It's the third in the Dominic Gray novel series. It's the follow-up to The Egyptian, and, of course, The Summoner was the first one. He is author Leighton Green. And, Leighton, we want to thank you so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
So, again, this is the third book in your Dominic Gray novel series. It's called The Diabolist. Why don't you give everybody a little bit of inside look inside the book, and maybe the series has it's progressed to date?
Sure thing. Well, for those of you who don't know, it's an international mystery/thriller series involving a pair of protagonists, a pair of guys that investigate cults worldwide. And it's not a narrow definition of cult; it's a wide one. So it could be anything from a religious cult, of course, to you know, the science of eternal aging, which was the topic of the second book, or there's a lot of different directions to go, because a cult is really just anything that is worshipped by a group of people. So, you know, there's cults from the Nazis to the you know, ancient satanic cults to cults all over the place. So I think it's kind of a different take, and I'm going to try to make each novel really unique and delve into a different, interesting area that kind of coincides with some modern topic as well. So that's the background to the series. The third novel, the first novel, The Summoner, started out in Zimbabwe investigating an indigenous African religion that came about from the disappearance of an American diplomat. And our protagonist, Dominic Gray, who's an ex-diplomatic security guy, also a martial arts expert, teams up with a religious phenomenologist, Victor Raddick. And a religious phenomenologist is basically someone that studies the subjective as opposed to the objective side of religion. So it kind of gets into the mysterious phenomena and all the belief systems. But he's an expert on cults, one of the world's foremost, if not the foremost. So then the next series of books, they team up to investigate a different cult each book. And the third book, The Diabolist, revolves around their investigation into the deaths, oddly coincidental deaths of some satanic leaders around the world.
And so why do you think that when people kind of hear the word cult, they immediately think satanic? When, like you said, the definition of it is basically just something that's done by a group of people. It's like you hear the word gang, you immediately think criminals. Has that just been a society thing that you know, that we've kind of transitioned ourselves into, is when we hear those words, we immediately think negativity instead of maybe thinking something else?
Yeah, I think you're right on the money. I mean, you know, in today's lexicon, the word kind of implies something that is negative. I don't know that it has to be, and I think that probably a lot of times it is, I think, because it implies that mindset of, okay, we're going to do whatever the group does, whatever the leader tells us to do. And, yeah, that's when the danger of cults arises, for sure. And, you know, the satanic issue, they're just some of the more notorious historical cults.
And so how much research and diving into, you know, different kinds of cults or different kinds of groups did you have to do when you started writing the series back with The Summoner?
Well, I do a lot of research. It's kind of the hallmark of the series. They get pretty in-depth into whatever it is they're investigating. So, you know, one thing I think people liked about the first novel was I got really in-depth into this ancient African religion, which is Nigerian Yoruban religion, which is kind of the precursor to voodoo type religions. It's not actually the direct ancestor to voodoo. That's a close but somewhat different religion from Benin, but same sort of sorcery based religion. It's a completely valid religion even today, but I extrapolated some of the bad parts of the religion, as every religion has, and, you know, kind of created a cult around it. But everything in there was based, in fact, and I think it was kind of spooky, and people liked that aspect of it. So that was, you're never quite sure where reality ends and where, you know, something beyond reality may start.
And so through the series, you've kind of taken people a little bit around the world. What kind of, you know, when you decided that this, you know, Dominic Gray was going to be a series that you were going to write, and you started in Zimbabwe. Why, you know, are you kind of taking, you know, people around the world in an order, or is it just like a totally random kind of thing that, that you do with each book?
It's random, but the a hallmark of the series is definitely international exotic locales. Probably every book, you know, there. Who knows if I'll write one totally in the United States, but the plan is for pretty much every book to take place partly or wholly in another country or countries.
So, yeah, when, you know, when you sit there and you think of these conscious kinds of things, do you kind of, you know, have five or six things laid out beforehand, like you already know where you're going to go? Because I'm sure you're working on the fourth book now, and possibly you already have the fifth book, a little bit of groundwork.
Absolutely. My friends and family accuse me of writing novels around where I want to travel, and I won't say that's completely false, but definitely impacted by the research as well. I kind of think, okay, what do I want to research and do with this book? Also, you know, where does that lead me? Where does it naturally take place? And I'll kind of just meld the two. And I love to travel. I'll go anywhere. So to me, every place in the world is interesting, at least the first time.
And have you had any, like, hands-on experience with some of the cults you maybe write about, going to maybe where they are, or speaking with people that have maybe gotten out of those or still in, you know, certain cults around the world?
I do really extensive research. So, yeah.
So we're just going to leave it with really extensive research. I mean, it's got to be a little bit, I guess, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's got to be a little bit scary maybe walking in for the first time just to see how kind of, you know, other sides live and kind of, you know, what they're like, because it's really such an unknown when you're walking into those types of things.
Yeah, it's really interesting, and I want to be interested by whatever it is that I write, so I pick religions, cults, whatever it may be that I think are fascinating, and provide kind of a different viewpoint on life as well. So, of course, there's going to be a fun thriller plot wrapped around it, but the backgrounds to a lot of these cults and religions is pretty interesting.
And, you know, your background, you know, you were, you know, attorney, and so you didn't really have the background, and an ESL teacher, you said you're Central America, you know, a bartender. So where did the fascination kind of come to kind of get yourself involved in this, seeing as maybe how, you know, your background does not really show that that's kind of what you've been doing?
I think that theology and philosophy have always been huge interests of mine, the supernatural as well. I mean, I'm a Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan, anything from fantasy literature to quasi-fantastical, you know, anything with that sort of speculative edge, I love. So all those wrapped together, I haven't, you know, worked in that field, but it's been a lifelong interest.
And so, again, I would remind everybody that we're speaking here with author Leighton Green and his latest book, which is the third book in the Dominic Gray novel series, The Diabolus. And so tell us about, who is Dominic Gray? How is he kind of transformed from the first book, The Summoner, until now into Diabolus? And exactly just who is he, and why is he the perfect person to star in your novels?
Yeah, I like Dominic a lot, of course. I guess, you know, since I wrote him, I should probably like him. But he's a guy that didn't have the best childhood. Full disclaimer, I actually had a great childhood, so not autobiographical, but you need to be interesting in fiction, so I made him interesting. But he's a guy that's kind of running from his past, doesn't really know where he's going. He's been a traveler all his life. His father was a Marine and not very nice to him, but he taught him to fight from a very early age, so he's really a martial arts expert. But he's very philosophical and contemplative. He's a man of violence and action who doesn't really like the fact that he is, so there's that tension there, and he's always exploring the purpose of violence and wishes he wasn't so violent. I think at heart he would like to be a pacifist, but he has these elements to him, which I think all of us have to some degree. So I explore that a lot. He's a guy that likes to see the world and do new things and searching for himself a little bit.
So, and just from being a listener, it sounded like that you kind of had the plots of your book laid out before you kind of decided, you know, who was gonna star in them. Would that be accurate?
Kind of. I knew what I wanted to write about. I practice Japanese jiu-jitsu And I knew I wanted that skill to be there. I knew I wanted to have travel and religion and suspenseful plots. So it all just kind of came together, and then I started developing the characters.
And so when you sit down and you think of the bad guy, what's the one character, two or three characteristics that you want to make sure that whether when you read or when you write, that you think that, you know, every bad guy really kind of needs to have to kind of be that great kind of villain bad guy that people hate and want to maybe see die at the end of the book?
Yeah, bad guys are tough, but they also make or break a book. I read in some writing book years ago that you should pretend that the bad guy, the antagonist, is the protagonist in his own novel. So you really want to get people to relate to him, and pretty much every bad guy, except for the straight-up, you know, psychopaths, do have, they can be sympathetic. They have reasons for their actions. You know, a lot of terrorists or you know, whoever it may be, is acting for a reason. Sure, some are pure evil, but usually not. So I like to explore that.
I always felt that, you know, the bad guys were the ones that kind of made the book, because they're the ones that kind of don't have the rules, where I think, you know, like the protagonists kind of, you know, they kind of have to follow some rules when you're writing them, but the villain don't. And that always fascinates me, when you can write without boundaries, you can kind of write without rules. Do you kind of feel the same way, like when you're, you know, sitting there and you're trying to piece all these kind of characters together? You know, which ones have the, you know, the morals, or which ones are going to stay within the boundaries, and which ones you're just going to let run free.
Exactly. It definitely creates for a different kind of character and can be interesting. Barry Eisler, I don't know if you know him. He's got a great series where his...
Oh, yeah, I know Barry.
Yeah, his lead character is, you know, an assassin who doesn't have a lot of morals. I'd say he has a few. But that's interesting, because he can take his protagonist in a lot of interesting directions. So, you're exactly right. Character.
That's always interesting too. And so when you have people that come up to you and they're just finding out about you, and they say, hey, you know, should I start at the beginning, should I not start at the beginning, you know, what do you tell them for new fans that are just finding out about your work?
The books are all absolutely standalone, but I would say start at the beginning. Just that's what I prefer, just so you can get all of the background. But each one can be read, so if one subject matter just appeals to you more than the other, I'd say start with that book. But if you just want the idea, like the idea of reading the series in general, start at the beginning.
And, you know, is there one character throughout the series, or that, you know, maybe you wrote in one of the books, like the Egyptian or the Sumner, or now in the Diabolist, kind of surprised you, that had a bigger voice, that you wanted to explore more, that people might see come back, or this and that, that you, like I said, that you just maybe wanted to explore more, that had a bigger voice than you didn't think they would when you first created them?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I just asked that question of my Facebook fans a few weeks ago, and they came up with this character named Jax, who's a mercenary. He was kind of the foil to Gray in book two. But going back to that question you asked a second ago, Jax is a character who doesn't have the morals that Gray does, so he can kind of go in a lot of different directions and do whatever he wants. But he does have, you know, his standards. He doesn't kill women and children and that sort of thing. But he's interesting in that his actions are, a lot more open.
Yeah, he can definitely go and do whatever he feels like. And that's always makes it. And so when that brings me to a good question. I'm glad that you mentioned Facebook, because I'm starting to ask authors, because I just kind of want to know, you know, 20 years ago, you know, 30 years ago, when there was no internet, no Facebook, no way to really have instant interaction, you kind of had to write the book and wait for the reviews, and then they kind of came out, and, you know, but you were already on book two by the time you sell the book one stuff. But now with the instantaneous part of Facebook and Twitter, and you're able to see fans' reaction right away instead of having to wait, does that kind of influence you moving forward with a new book when you know what really interests them and what really makes them tick and what fascinates them when you're writing the next book?
I think it definitely helps. I'm pretty new as an author, so I wasn't around in the old system, and I'm curious as to, I guess you were writing in more of a vacuum until all the sales got in. But that being said, you know, once you publish the book and it's out there, whether everything flows in a day or 6 months later, it's kind of done and out there. So before you write a book is really when you got to think what's going to happen, you know, what's going to be interesting. So yeah, I think it's probably an ongoing balance of those two.
And so when your fans, you know, when they mention that character, Jack, as far as like that, you know, that character that kind of, you know, intrigues them, did that surprise you?
Not too much. I liked him too. So I kind of expected that a little bit, but that's a great, you know, going back to the question you just asked, what is influential about your fans and how you see reactions instantaneously, being able to get that feedback is awesome. Yeah, when you start writing, what can I do with my next book? Oh, they all want to see Jack, so maybe I'll put him in the next book. So they do go together really well.
Yeah, and, you know, some authors I've always wondered if maybe you take Dominic and, you know, at the very beginning he winds up, you know, getting shot and is in the hospital and really can't do anything, and maybe you have Jack kind of being the forefront in maybe his book and kind of seeing maybe how that rolls. I don't know if that's something that, you know, thought, but that's just kind of like a way that you can kind of see, you know, to the fans, hey, you wanted Jack, here he is, now what do you think?
Exactly. Yeah, there's a lot that can be done there.
Yeah, and I didn't know a lot of people that write series now, and I don't know if you thought about this, but have you thought about maybe writing like bridge novellas, kind of like little novellas that bridge you into the next book and give those, you know, those characters a little bit more development, you know, that your fans can see?
Absolutely. I've thought about that a lot, and I will probably most definitely be doing some of that.
And is Dominic Gray like the character that you're going to continue on with? And are you going to do anything else outside maybe like the norm?
In terms of the series or outside of this series?
Yeah, are you gonna do like maybe like a total standalone book or just something totally different? Or is Dominic just the main focus of your writing right now?
No, I've actually got a couple of standalones and a fantasy series I just started as well. So I'm definitely going to have some more work out there in the next year or two. When will be a question, but I think I'll have something besides the Dominic Gray series out in the next, I'd say, 6 to 9 months.
And, you know, since you're still are, you know, kind of, I guess, new into the, you know, the whole thriller author genre kind of series, what's the one thing that you kind of learned now over the years or that you've changed, you know, as far as, you know, marketing and having to talk with fans and getting out and being on shows like this or on blogs? Was it something that was natural for you at the beginning? Was it not natural? Have you been able to adapt? How's that journey been?
Not too bad. I'm a litigator by training, so I was, you know, in court, and I was always in conferences or talking, and that's not a big deal. It's far more enjoyable to talk about my books in law, I'll say that. it's not like I'm speaking to packed crowds of 30,000 either, so it's ask me after that happens, maybe we'll have a different answer. But, no, it's been great. I love talking about my work and to my fans and, you know, to you guys. So it's been an awesome ride.
And have you had, like, one piece of advice maybe from, like, an author, you know, somebody that, you know, that's big or whatnot that you were able to talk to that told you something that's always maybe, like, stuck with you from the beginning that you're kind of taking, with you now throughout your career?
That's a great question. Someone told me to write what I believe, and I really like that advice. I think it's probably what I would do anyway, but a lot of people say write what you love. You know, decent advice, maybe what you love is interesting, maybe it's not, you know, blah, blah, blah. I think write what you believe is really good advice to young writers because whatever you believe in, you're going to be interested in, you're going to feel compelled to write about it, and it's going to be great. So I guess that.
And who was that? Can you say who told you that? What author told you that?
Yeah, he's a writer named Daniel Judson. He's not that huge, but he's a really great speaker and interesting. And Daniel Judson.
And so, when you kind of came out here with, you know, with the Sumner and. You weren't really sure, okay, how are fans going to like it? I mean, oh, my God, are they going to like it? Are they not going to like it? What the hell am I getting myself into? How did it feel kind of when you started getting those first reviews back and they were positive and you know, did it lift a big weight off of your shoulders? Or did it give you kind of more pressure because you're like, damn, now I got to really do better with the second book that I'm writing and I feel more pressure? Kind of wish they were just kind of lukewarm because I don't have to put pressure on me.
No, definitely the former. It was really great to have actual fans that weren't editors or friends and family or readers, no matter how unbiased you think someone is, you know, your real test is when someone who does not know you posts a review online or in a magazine or something. So that was really great to have some validation there, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I see that, you know, like Steve Barry wrote, wrote a review for you, and he's a really great guy. And I don't know, are you involved with the ITW at all?
I am, yeah. It's pretty awesome organization. I haven't been to Thriller Fest yet. I've been meaning to go the last 2 years, and just life things got in the way, but hopefully I'll be there next year.
Yeah, no, we go every year, and it's definitely the best conference for authors, without a doubt, because of the Craft Fest and all the things that you get to do and all the things that you get to see and the people you can talk to, where maybe VoucherCon is a little more fan thing. But I think that for an author and his craft, it's definitely something that you want to get involved in, is going to Thriller Fest. And with the ITW, you know, what have they done for you as far as, you know, just helping you out? I see that, and I was just on your site, and so I see now that you did do the Big Thrill newsletter, and that's always a great thing. I write for the Big Thrill, and so I get to interview someone. So what have you been taking away from the ITW? What have you been able to kind of do with them that have really helped you going forward?
So far, I've advertised with them some. I've been in the Big Thrill. But just the authors I've met just online so far through the ITW have been really great and helpful and supportive. It's a pretty fantastic organization. I have nothing but great things to say about it.
Yeah, and you got to definitely hit Thriller Fest. And, you know, maybe we'll see you out there next year. That would be great. Get yourself on a panel, start talking, getting out there, seeing people. I mean, it's always fun to just be able to walk around and all of a sudden you're just like, oh, there goes, you know, Michael Conley. Hey, Michael, how are you doing? You know, just kind of those, like, little things. And you actually start becoming a fan also, because you start seeing all these people around. You know, you're like, I always call, you know, Thriller Fest, this is the place where 99 billion books are sold. Because of all these authors that are around, it just kind of reminds me of, like, you know, McDonald's walking in. So we always love going.
Yeah, for sure. I really hope to go next year.
Yeah. So as far as, like, Leighton Green, you know, the person maybe outside, what would you want to, like, tell fans, like, you know, like, who you are, you know, maybe, like, as a person that's standing, like, you know, like, outside of the books, you know, maybe things that you do for fun, things you just go out and you just kind of, you know, you play golf, you do anything like that, you like to run, hike?
Yeah, I practice jiu-jitsu. I used to be a big beach volleyball player and a soccer player. I've got two young kids, so doing anything. I go run around the neighborhood as fast as possible and then go back inside. But, yeah, in terms of lifelong interests, reading, of course. I've got a bunch of interests that were really useful in, like, the 17th century, like jiu-jitsu and Romance languages and chess. But I love to travel. I'll go anywhere at any time at any opportunity.
And now, are you still in New Orleans?
I live in Atlanta right now.
Oh, okay. So you're still down that southern area. So you get, you know, that kind of southern flair, which is a little bit different, of course, than, you know, the north. It's still different. So I guess, you know, you just have a lot of different I think fans are actually different from the southern to, like, maybe, like, the northern part of the country. Do you kind of sense that when you go to different places, that fans in different areas are just different?
That's interesting. I'd be interested in your take on that. I haven't noticed that as much in person. Probably because I haven't been around in person that much. But do you think they correspond to how they are in the cliches, the northern, the southern Californian?
Yes. The Northern California and Southern California definitely should be two states, because they act like two different things. This is how I correlate it, if you've never been. But Vegas is Southern California. It's glitzy, it's glamour, it's nonstop, it's busy, it's crowded, and that's Vegas. Northern California is Reno. It's quiet. It's a little more snobbish. It's a little more outdoorsy. It's more kind of in the mountains. It's a lot more laid back. And that's Northern California, like San Francisco. So you got San Francisco's Reno, and L.A. and San Diego are Vegas. And that's the best way to explain it. But the other thing that's, you know, when I always authors, like from the UK and from the United States, they always kind of say that UK fans, of course, are much different than the United States fans. We focus on different things than they focus over there. And I think the same goes for the North and the South. Just because it's just how you grow up and the things that interest you, you kind of see sales in different areas of, like, you know, when you're writing in the Bible Belt and you're writing about cults, that's a little bit more controversial down in the South than it would be in the North.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. I've actually had quite a few Christians comment on my book reviews that they do like it because they explore. Some can be put off, but my books are much more about exploration than kind of pigeonholing. These aren't books where, you know, they just go and blast religions. It's more of, this is what this is, weird things happen, is it real, is it not? So yeah, I've had some good comments there. And speaking of different kinds of fans, Germans seem to love these books for some reason. They really get into the occult thing and mysterious, suspenseful works like that. So yeah internationally, I see more differences internationally, I think.
Yeah, I'm German, and I can definitely relate that they are huge cult horror fans. That kind of read. That is, they love to read that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what, Leighton, we want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been a blast to be able to speak with you about your books, and we wish you nothing but the success in the future. And maybe we'll see you out there in July at Thriller Fest, and, you know, we can talk a little further.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me so much.
All right, you have a good one. Enjoy. So again, everybody, that is author Leighton Green with his book, The Diabolist, the third in his Dominic Gray series. Again, we're giving you all these fabulous authors, all these fabulous books. Christmas is coming up. Sit and read. You live in those areas where the weather is not going to be that good. You can sit outside, see the snow fall, reading your books. You know, we want to thank all three of our authors, Joshua Graham, Jeffrey Girard, and Leighton Green, for coming on the show today and speaking about that. The November issue is out. We are taking votes on the December Best Of. Who's going to win the Crimson Scribe Award? Last year with Tess Garrison. This year, let's see who wins it. Check out suspensemagazine.com. If you have any questions, you can email editor@suspensemagazine.com. We are going to have a new website up for the radio show. It's going to be crimeandsuspenseradio.com. You go there now, it's under construction. So if you don't like construction, don't go there now. But it's going to be up, and it's going to have all the radio show information in one spot at crimeandsuspenseradio.com. So again, we will see everybody in a couple weeks on Suspense Radio. And don't forget tomorrow, one-on-one, 10 o'clock. See you later.